Brent?
Yes.
It's Mike. How are you?
Hello, Mike.
Are
we live on the air?
We are, because I have no professionalism and I just do things randomly like this. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. As I'm preparing as best as I can. How are you?
I'm good. So you know, even though you are, I've determined, I'm recording this on Saturday night, but you're going to be like probably published on Thursday because you're going to be the main event of this week. I'm doing an entire week where I talk to the major religions, somebody from the major religions of Jews, Christians, Muslims, and I'll throw in an atheist because why not, even though going to hell. And I thought, there is no better Jew in the world to talk to than Brent Kremen. So Brent,
there are plenty of better Jews than me. Dave Meltzer's probably a better Jew than me.
I don't know if he knows the faith as well as you do, though.
Oh, I do my best. There are plenty more worthy candidates, and I hope that I do not give out any false information. I'll do the very best that I can. Thank you.
Again, this
I appreciate your kind words.
This is halfguarded.com, Halfguarded Hour. Get my bullshit plugs in now, because I have a feeling a lot of people from the board will be interested in hearing you, because you're basically a madman, Brent. You know that, right?
Yes. I am well aware. Recently on Brian's show, he described my behavior at the dinner for WrestleMania at the Texas Brazil Brazilian Steakhouse, and I think he described me fairly aptly. But I'm just me. But I can tend to play it up.
No, that's fine. And you know, again, for you and anybody who has not listened to any of this, again, I'm talking to everybody about the basic major Western religions. And even though halfguarded.com, cheap plug, is a joke of a website, I kind of want to give people an actual, you know, a little bit of a background on what's going on. You know, why do people believe in certain things? And what are the common questions that people like me, for example, who's a moron, might have? And I have a feeling you'll be pretty good with the Jewish stuff. So the first question I have, and I think a lot of people in America would ask, is what do Jewish people think about Jesus?
Okay. Well, I want to give the best answer that I can. So I am going to go to a book that's been out for a few decades, originally written by Alfred Kolach, called The Second Jewish Book of Why. Let's see.
Do you have an entire bookshelf of books dedicated to being Jewish?
Yes.
Okay.
Because Jews are the people of the book, and so we have our, we have our holy book, the Tanakh, which is basically what Christians call the Old Testament. However, we have various commentaries on that, and the old joke is you talk to two Jews, you get three opinions. However, the books of commentary, the Talmud, the Midrash, these are, when they talk about the rabbi's commentary, they're referring to the rabbis of long ago, Rashi, etc. However, there are modern commentators and modern people that explain, and so Alfred Kolach is one of them that wrote the Jewish Book of Why, the Second Jewish Book of Why. I also recommend a book called What is a Jew by Morris Kurtzler and Rabbi Lawrence Hoffman.
Fair enough. Okay, so going back to the original question, what is the Jewish position on Jesus?
Okay, this is from the Second Jewish Book of Why. I hope that you can be patient.
Sure.
It says, why were times ripe in the days of Jesus for Jews to accept him as the Messiah? For a full century following the death of Jesus, the Jews of Palestine suffered under the yoke of the occupying Roman forces. Their political and military stranglehold left the country in desperate straits, and many among the poverty-stricken population lived in deplorable conditions. Efforts at rebellion failed, and hope for a brighter future waned. Conditions were therefore ripe for the ideas of preachers who promised a better life. Flavius Josephus, the great Jewish Palestinian historian who lived in the first century CE, records how the years before and after the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70 CE, which stands for Common Era. It's commonly known as AD in Christianity, came forward to the be the Redeemer foretold by the Jewish prophets. Jesus was one of those men who, through his preaching, was successful in attracting a following. He offered the poor and oppressed hope for a better world, but in his lifetime and for many decades that followed, those who claimed Jesus was the Messiah, the one coming of the prophets had prophesied, were unable to win over the oppressed Jewish masses. Why, after the death of Jesus, were most Jews reluctant to accept him as the Messiah? Of the Jews living in Palestine in the early centuries following the death of Jesus, relatively few accepted him as the Messiah, whose coming, some claimed, was predicted by the prophets of Israel. In Jewish tradition, the arrival of the Messiah was to bring with it the amelioration of oppressive conditions and the restoration of Israel to its former glory. In other words, when the Jews are no longer oppressed and Israel is like its former glory, when the temple is rebuilt, basically, then the Messiah will arrive. Maimonides summarized what Jews looking forward to in the Messianic age. There will be no hunger or war, no jealousy or strife. Prosperity will be universal, and the world's chief occupation will be to know the Lord. Since these conditions did not come to pass, the idea of Jesus as the Messiah never took root among the Jews, and the followers of Jesus therefore turned to the pagan community in search of converts. Why do Jewish scholars believe Jesus did not think of himself as the Messiah? Many Jewish scholars believe Jesus considered himself a prophet only. They reject the contention of Christian scholars that when Jesus used the phrase Son of Man in his preaching, first mentioned in Daniel 17, when the Aramaic phrase Bar Enesh is used, he was referring to himself as the Messiah. The phrase Son of Man in the Jewish view is used in the third person, and more likely than not, when Jesus used the phrase, he was referring to someone other than himself. Jewish scholars also point to the fact that the early evidence in the Synoptic Gospels, that would be Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the earliest accounts on the life of Jesus, that Jesus regarded himself as the Messiah. Why are most Jews unwilling to regard Jesus as a prophet? Over the years, Christian as well as some Jewish scholars and writers have been making the point that all Jews may not be willing to accept Jesus as the Messiah or the Son of God. They should at least accept him as a prophet. This thesis is rejected because none of the prophets of Israel spoke in his own name. None ever presented himself as the originator of his own prophecies. The Jewish prophets considered themselves the mouthpiece of God. God, they believed, was speaking through them. For this reason, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and other Jewish prophets introduced their prophecies and admonitions with the word, Thus saith the Lord. When Jesus introduces his prophecies and admonitions, he does so with the words, I say unto you, clearly suggesting he saw himself as the authority. The attitude is reflected in many New Testament passages. In Matthew 9:6, for example, Jesus represents himself as the Son of Man who has power on earth to forgive sins. In John 13:13, Jesus says, you call me Master and Lord, and ye say well, for so I am. Since Jesus portrayed himself as more than a spokesman of the Lord, Jews are unable to accept him as a prophet. Why do Jews not accept the Christian idea that God became a man in Jesus? The unity of God and his incorporeal.
How many more pages of this is there?
We got about two more paragraphs, and that's it.
Okay, I'll let you go right then. Let's go.
Great. Why do Jews not accept the Christian idea that God became a man in Jesus? The unity of God and his incorporeality, which, in other words, God has no form, is a basic Jewish belief. The Talmud contains many passages reflecting this, and 12th century scholar Moses Maimonides, also known as, Rambam, I believe, later emphasized in his 13 Articles of Faith, Maimonides condemns anyone who takes literally such biblical expressions as the hand of God or the finger of God or Moses viewing the back of God. The Yigdal hymn, which was written by David von Judah Dayan in the 14th century and which is said to be found in all prayer books today, is based on the Creed Maimonides. The hymn expressed the Jewish belief that God is spiritual in nature, that he's without body, without human form. The tenet runs counter to the doctrine of incarnation accepted by most Christian denominations, including some of the most progressive. According to the Christian doctrine of incarnation, God transformed himself into human life in the form of Jesus. To Jews that believe that God is one and unchangeable, this doctrine is unacceptable. So, there's your answer.
So, basically, he was a nice guy, but he was not God, and he kind of maybe embellished a little bit about his credentials.
He was a nice Jewish boy, and personally I believe that, based on scholars saying that the Jewish Bible and the Christian Bible were written well after these events supposedly happened, I believe that the quotes that were attributed to him, he never said. And so I believe that he never claimed to be the Son of God. I believe he never said these things. I believe that the Christian Bible was written during a time where they were trying to differentiate themselves from Judaism, and they were trying to form their own faith. And so I don't think he said those things, but I can see how a Christian would be offended by that thought.
First of all, you're not going to offend anyone. Speak the truth as far as you know it. Does that mean the Jews will then see Jesus as like a prophet? Forget Jews. Like, I know you can't speak for all millions and millions of Jews, but do you see Jesus as a prophet?
No. The book clearly says that we do not regard Jesus as a prophet. The quote that I like is, he was a nice Jewish boy.
Fair enough. He was a mama's boy, like most Jewish men are.
Sure.
I have this written down at the very end, but let's go over the Jewish mother thing. There's the idea that Jewish moms are, like, overbearing and all that stuff. Is that true?
It's a stereotype, sure. There's probably some truth to it, as there are in most stereotypes. If you've seen Curb Your Enthusiasm, Susie is a pretty amusing example of somebody that considers herself an observant Jew, definitely overbearing, obnoxious, and does not really, the way that she behaves is not really Jewish values, but she would consider herself an observant Jew. But she's clearly not a very nice person.
Well, that's pretty clear, actually. But you are an observant Jew. Is that fair to say?
I like to consider myself an observant Reform Jew, the Reformer, the most liberal, and I, there certainly are better Jews than me. I do my best, but I'm a Reform Jew that chooses to embrace more tradition.
Well, that's right.
Now, I certainly have my flaws, as a lot of people have observed.
I see no flaws whatsoever in you. But I was going to ask, as far as like Judaism, I know I see it, and I know people that are Hasidic Jews, Orthodox Jews, Reformed. I think there's six or seven different branches of Judaism. Kind of a summary, what's the big differences between all these different versions of Judaism?
Well, the Judaism has always changed. Over the years, Orthodox say that we are the way that Judaism traditionally is and has been. But if you take the biblical figures and you stick them in a Chabad Lubavitch, they would be known as Hasidics. If you stick them into one of their synagogues, they would have no idea what that is. Because Judaism has changed over the years. But the Orthodox are the most traditional, and then there are the conservative, the Reform, and the Reconstructionist. Basically, there was just Judaism until about the 1860s, and the 1860s was during the Enlightenment period, and much as Christianity was changing and recognizing science, Judaism was changing and recognizing science. And one of our most central prayers, the Shema, which continues, the Reform call it the part where it continues after the first two lines, the Via Hafta, where it talks about the part that the Reform Jews took out, which was, if you do not follow these laws, then your crops will not grow. And Reform Jews saw, the leaders, well, they weren't Reform Jews yet, these rebellious rabbis saw that it doesn't work that way. There are plenty of people that do not follow the commandments, and they're farmers or whatever, and their crops grow. And so they say, well, this is stupid. It doesn't really work that way. So they took it out. And they decided that what was worth keeping was all of the ethical laws. Anything ceremonial would drop. And because it started in Germany, they decided that they would not do much of the service in Hebrew, and they would do it in the local language, which was German. And so they would do it in German, and rather than go and face the podium towards the congregation, we call it the bima. They would go and they would face it. Rather than face it towards the ark where you keep the Torah, they faced it towards the congregation, like the Lutherans did. And so they made it like everything that you did in Germany. And rather than have a bar and bat mitzvah at age 13, they decided, 13, you're not mature enough. So they changed it to 16 and they called it confirmation. And so they did everything that the German Jews did, and they shaved their beards, and they stopped wearing head coverings, and they stopped wearing tallit, and they wanted to go and blend in and be as much like the Christians that they were surrounded by in Germany as they possibly could. And that worked from about the 1860s until the 1930s, and then not so much. Because ultimately, the Nazis didn't care whether we looked like them, whether we acted like them, whether we did their services, whether we ate their food. They didn't care. They were all the same, and they all ended up in the same place. So, back in America, after a lot of these German Jews came to America, they decided that they wanted to go and form what the reform movement was going to be in America. And so they decided they were going to have a meal. And they brought in cheese, and they brought in pork, and they brought in shellfish, and they brought in all this non-kosher food. And they called it the Trefa Banquet. Trefa means torn. So they purposely decided, we're going to go and we're going to eat all of this food that isn't kosher because we want to make a point that those are ceremonial laws. They're not ethical. They're not important to us anymore, and we're going to throw all that out. And then what happened is some of these rebellious rabbis walked out, and they said, you've gone too far. You reformers have gone too far. And they formed the conservative movement. And the conservative movement is somewhere between Orthodox traditional Judaism and Reform, where they believe that Halakha is what is known as Jewish law. The Reform alone believe that Jewish law is not binding. All you need to do is you need to have an informed choice. You need to look at every law. There are 613 laws, and there's a couple hundred of them that are only valid when the temple is standing. And Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox Judaism all agree the ones that were around from when the temple is standing, you don't have to do those. So the other ones that are remaining, the Reform Jews say you're supposed to study them and decide whether they are meaningful for you or not. And if they're not meaningful for you, aside from the ethical ones, you don't have to follow them. The conservative say, these are binding. You have to follow them. However, they are willing to twist themselves into pretzels in order to not follow the ones that seem unreasonable. So basically, the conservative, they have women rabbis. They're pretty liberal. So politically, they're liberal, just like the Reform are. They'll conduct gay weddings, etc. Their politics are much like the Reform.
Okay,
and the Reconstructionists is a movement that broke away from the conservative.
Brent, can you hear me right now?
Sure.
Okay, sorry. My microphone went screwed for a second. Before we go any further, you mentioned the temple. What is the temple? Because I kind of have an idea from a Christian perspective. Jesus talked about the temple. But for people that don't know, what is, when Jews talk about the temple, what is the temple?
The temple was built by Solomon and was destroyed by the Babylonians, and then, as Jesus predicted, was destroyed by the Romans. And so once the temple was destroyed, the animal sacrifice, the whole idea of sacrifice, that all ended, and the priests were no longer had a role because there was no temple for the priests to perform their duties in, and so we got rabbis, which basically took over, and the rabbis literally means teachers, and the rabbis have they're no more holy than we are. They're no more holy than the lay people. They just basically have more knowledge because their job is to study Judaism and teach Judaism and be leaders. That's their job. But they stand like anyone else, and they have no higher place than anyone else. Then we're supposed to respect them because they are our teachers.
So at one point there were,
they were priests. Where do you think the Catholics got the idea of priests?
I assume from a sex shop, but we'll go with, whatever. So there were priests and there were rabbis, but there are no longer priests within Judaism. Is that correct?
Correct. Those went out when the temple was destroyed.
If the temple comes back, would there then be priests?
Yes.
And
however, in order for the temple to come back, the Dome of the Rock would have to be torn down, and any sane person would say that would bring on World War III. And there's a small minority of crazy Jews, and as well as evangelical Christians that want to destroy the Dome of the Rock, rebuild the temple, which is impossible because as soon as you start destroying the Dome of the Rock, it's offensive to Muslims. That's a holy place for them, a third holiest in Islam, and so therefore that would bring on World War III. So it's impossible. For all practical purposes, it's impossible for the temple to be rebuilt, and Judaism will never go back the way it was, and there will never be priests again for all practical purposes.
Does that mean that the prophecy contained within the Torah will never be fulfilled?
Correct. If the temple is never rebuilt, then things will never be as that way. Yeah, we will never be able to do certain things. Correct.
All right. And I take this as somewhat reverential, but I want to be questioning from a Catholic Christian perspective. The main difference I see between Jews and Muslims is that neither one of you believe that Jesus was God. Do Jews have an opinion on Muhammad? And let's start there. Do Jews have an opinion on Muhammad?
Muhammad was a man of God who was responsible for forming a faith that worships the same God that Jews and Christians do.
And I probably should have asked the Muslim I had on earlier, but are Jews and Muslims really any different then as far as what they actually believe? Because again, Christians believe that there was a dude named Jesus. He came back. He was, God and all this stuff. But Jews and Muslims both say, oh, Jesus was a nice guy, but we don't believe he was God. And everything else seems to be more or less the same. So are Muslims basically Jewish?
No. Muslims, they believe that Moses was a prophet, which they agree with Jews on. They believe that Jesus was a prophet, which Jews do not agree with them on. And they believe that Muhammad was a prophet, and what Muhammad said superseded anything that happened previously. The Jews obviously don't agree with that.
Okay, that's fair enough. I was going to ask, also I've written now, you mentioned the Torah before. The Torah is more or less what we call the Old Testament.
Not exactly. The Torah is the first five books of Moses, just the first five books of Moses, not the entire, what Christians call the Old Testament, just the five books of Moses that are written in a scroll in Hebrew by hand.
What are those books?
Well, the first five books are Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy.
Okay.
And they have to be written in a scroll, and they have to be written by hand. A sofer, a scribe, writes them. They take various lambskin, and they go and they sort of knit it together. And so you go, and if you screw up one letter, you have to rip. You have to take the entire page out. You unbind it from the rest of the scroll, and you have to do that whole thing over the whole page if you screw up one letter.
And were these basically confirmed, I guess, by the so-called Dead Sea Scrolls discovered within the past 100 years?
I think that the Dead Sea Scrolls were copies of stuff that is mainly about Christian theology, I believe.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask then, so the Torah is some of the Old Testament. What is the Tanakh, for those who don't know?
The Tanakh is the Hebrew translation. You have the Hebrew, and then you can translate it directly from the Hebrew into whatever your native language is, and that would be basically what Christians call the Old Testament, but the translations are slightly different.
Well, what's the difference between the Torah and the Tanakh?
The Torah is just the first five books in the Tanakh.
Okay, and
the Torah is in a scroll that is handwritten in Hebrew, and the Tanakh can be is in a book form with pages and can be written in any language.
How many? I think you said what there are six or seven in the Torah. Is that correct?
No, five.
Five. Okay.
First five books of both.
How many are there in the Tanakh?
I couldn't tell you offhand. I'm embarrassed.
But are no, that's fine.
Basically, if you have a Christian Bible, and you go through the books that are considered to be the Old Testament, that would be the number. You can count them.
And would everything? How do I say this? Do Jewish people regard everything within the Tanakh as being the Word of God?
Yes. Well, that's not totally accurate. The Orthodox believe that it is the Word of God that was. Then the conservative believe that it is the Word of God written and interpreted by a man. And most Reform rabbis would say that it is divinely inspired men that wrote it and. There's a lot of Reform rabbis would say that a lot in it did not actually happen.
If you ask them, they didn't actually happen.
Some of them would say the Exodus didn't actually happen, and they would say it doesn't matter whether it happened or not. We can still learn ethical lessons from it, and it is a book that binds us together as a people. And so, regardless of whether it actually happened or not, it just doesn't matter. You can see why the Reform are rebels.
What do you think?
You can see why we are very different from the other forms of Judaism. However, we are the most popular. Even though we have been around only since the 1860s, probably 60% of American Jews would identify as Reform, even though we're the rebels.
That kind of leads me into the idea that historically, for thousands of years, Judaism was partially religious, but also somewhat non-religious. It was like a race that was passed down through the mother. And
correct.
What is the difference from your perspective, if there is one, between somebody that converts to Judaism and says, I'm a Jew because I love, I believe in the faith, as opposed to someone that is, we'll say ethnically Jewish, even if they don't, aren't super orthodox or anything like that. Like, is there a difference within the way Jews see things?
Well, I explained to you that Reform Jews and Reform rabbis, if you ask them privately, a lot of them would say that a lot of the stuff in the Tanakh didn't even happen. And so therefore, if their mother is Jewish and you talk to an Orthodox rabbi, they would say they are Jews, but clearly they are not practicing Judaism. And so if they're not practicing Judaism, their conversions would not be recognized. Furthermore, the conservative conversions are not recognized by the Orthodox rabbi. So basically, if you have an Orthodox conversion, that's recognized by the Orthodox, it's recognized by the conservative, it's recognized by the Reform. If you have a conservative conversion, it's recognized by the conservative and the Reform. So basically, any denomination and any more liberal denominations will recognize a conversion, but the more traditional, so that's the way it works. But assuming that a denomination is recognized, assuming that a conversion is recognized by a denomination, it says in Leviticus, if a stranger sojourns within your land, you shall not do him wrong. We just studied this today. This is Leviticus 33 and 34. The stranger that sojourns with you shall be on you as your homeborn among you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you strangers in the lands of Egypt, I am the Lord your God. It says, Rashi said, the medieval Jewish commentator says, do not taunt him verbally. Do not say unto him, yesterday you were an idol worshiper, and today you shall learn Torah. With regard for you were strangers, do not accuse your fellow man of his own defect. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. This is from the modern conservative commentary. Remembering our Egyptian experience, we might wish to be like Egyptians, for we have the opportunity of oppressing the powerless in our midst. Therefore, the Torah warns us to use the memory of slavery in Egypt to learn empathy for the oppressed. A stranger, the stranger, a ger in the Bible, is most often referred to a foreign merchant, a craftsman, or mercenary soldier. The term never refers to prior inheritance of the land or identified by ethnological groupings such as Canaanites or Amorites, or other specifically form of reference. So basically, once you convert, you are as Jewish as anyone else, assuming your conversion is recognized.
Okay.
You know, once you're granted a conversion, that's it. That's all. You're Jewish. You can do whatever you want. You can go and choose to practice another faith, even if you want. You're still Jewish. Once it's done, it's done.
So basically, if I convert, I can go to Hollywood and get a job.
Yeah, that's funny. There you go.
I want to ask, from the Jewish perspective, who wrote the Torah, basically?
Well, the traditional view is that God told Moses what to write, and Moses wrote it. That's the traditional view.
Okay.
The scholarly view, which the Reform tend to go along with, was that it was written by a series of people who were religious geniuses. Was written by a series of people over time.
What is a religious genius, I guess?
Somebody who is inspired by God, somebody who's a very ethical person, somebody who's very smart, somebody who's inspiring, God.
So basically, people inspired by God directly. Is that fair to say?
You could say that, although Jews are very hesitant to talk about God spoke to me directly and told me this. Jews are very hesitant to talk about that in modern times.
Except for the burning
We're
bush.
Uncomfortable with the idea.
The burning Moses talking
there
about
you go.
The burning bush, you know, like, that's
well, fair. During biblical times, that's correct. But during modern times, we're a bit uncomfortable discussing that. I mean, you would have to ask a Reform rabbi what exactly it means to be inspired by God to write the Torah.
No, that's
you'd have to ask a Reform rabbi. I don't know.
That's fair. I've dealt with my fair share of burning bushes over the years. I want to ask, as far as the afterlife is concerned, Catholics and Muslims and such have the idea of heaven and hell. What is the Jewish position on the afterlife?
It's not something that we focus on a great deal. Our purpose is our life on earth, and that we believe that God is just, and that if we follow the commandments, we will have a place in the world to come. You know, there are legends about Gehenna, which was the name of a garbage pit during biblical times. There's stories of Sheol, which was the place of the dead, and everyone went there. But generally, the afterlife did not exercise the Jewish imagination. And we're much more focused on following the commandments and making life better for our fellow man.
Well, and that's fine, but obviously everybody in the world thinks about what happens when they die. So, and you're not speaking for all Jews, however many millions are left, but what do you think happens when you die?
Well, I like to personally think that that we have a soul, the body is left, and our soul survives, and we join all righteous souls of any religion. Anyone who lived a righteous life, we join them, and that those that did. I like to imagine that those that did not live a righteous life, their souls also survive, and that God is there for them. you know, that they can communicate with God. However, they're kind of alone, and they can't communicate with anyone else. They can only communicate with God. They cannot communicate with the other dead. They cannot communicate with the living, and then they have an eternity. They have an eternity alone with themselves and with God to go and think about what they've done. That doesn't sound very pleasant to me. That's what I like to imagine.
That's way better than my mom's view. That if you don't love Jesus, you're going to hell. So I was kind of keep on that subject. There's a Jewish idea of that Jews are the chosen people. Is that based on an ethnic racial belief? Is it based on people that convert? Are if I woke up tomorrow and said I want to be Jewish, would Jewish people say you're now part of the chosen people, or do I have to have a mother that was Jewish in order to become part of the chosen people?
No, we accept converts. You have to go and go through a process. You have to learn about Judaism. Traditionally, in traditional Jewish communities, they will turn you away twice. Come on, why would you want to be one of us? All you need to you're Christian. That's perfectly fine. That works. You believe you're worshiping one God. You have systems of justice. You don't eat from live animals. You know, you're fine the way you are. You don't need to be one of us. Why would you want to be one of us? Because in order to be one of the chosen people, you have to follow all these extra laws that you don't have to do. You have to keep kosher. You have to rest on the Sabbath. You have to do all these extra things that we have to do that you don't have to do. You have it much easier. Stay the way you are. And so they'll go and they will turn you down twice. And the third time, if you come back and you continue coming back and you continue to learn and you continue to embrace and you continue to change your ways and embrace our ways, then you are accepted as Jewish. In the conservative and the reform, it's a little less stringent, and the reforms certainly don't turn you away. I mean, you'll see all sorts of people. The reform do introduction to Judaism classes, and you have to get to be knowledgeable. And the reform view is that, as I said, these commandments are not binding, but they all require education and acceptance of whatever the denomination considers to be mandatory.
You mentioned it, and I talked about the Muslim guest we had earlier this week. As a Christian Catholic dude, I can eat whatever I want, whenever I want, except for fish,
yes,
or whatever. Why do Jews, and I guess Muslims, but more, why do Jews not eat pork? What's the problem with Jews and bacon, basically?
Well, it says in Leviticus that is forbidden. Let's see here. It says
you don't have to read it.
Why are kosher dietary laws observed? This is from the Jewish Book of Why by Alfred Kolech. Observance of the laws of kashrut has been a unifying factor for the Jewish people throughout the ages, continuing serving to remind Jews of their roots. The primary dietary laws are set forth in the Book of Leviticus, where a list of kosher and non-kosher animals is given. The rationale for these laws is not mentioned. The Bible merely states that these laws observed because I am the Lord that brought thee out of Egypt to be your God. I therefore am holy. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. Leviticus 11:44. Holiness is the only reason given in the Bible for the observance of dietary laws. Orthodox and conservative Jews subscribe to the dietary laws, although there are various degrees of observance. Reformed Jews, by and large, do not observe them, although many refrain from eating pork or pork products. As I mentioned, the early reformers in 1885, the Pittsburgh Platform, purposely ate pork and shellfish and decided all that was meaningless. Later on, that's changed, and they've embraced some of that. But basically, it talks about you shall... why are animals that chew their cud and have not split and have split hooves are kosher, but others are not? The Bible gives no reason why animals with split hooves and chew their cud are kosher, nor does it explain why a certain fish and certain fowl are kosher, while others are not. All explanations are purely speculative. So basically it says in Leviticus, those animals that chew their cud and have split hooves are kosher. Those that do not have split hooves and do not chew their cud or don't do both are not kosher. And so the pig has a bad reputation because they say the pig's like out there, look at my split hooves, look at my split hooves, look at my split hooves. I'm kosher. But it doesn't chew its cud, so no.
Do you observe kosher then?
Personally, I do not eat pork. I do not eat shellfish. And I try not to have meat and dairy together. However, if I am... at my aunt and uncle's place, and they don't keep kosher at all, and they have, you know, they have a dish that has mixed meat and dairy in it, and there's not really an alternative for another entree, I would probably eat it because I don't want to hurt my aunt and uncle's feelings, and I think family is more important, recognizing they don't keep kosher at all. Hardly anyone in my nobody in my family really does, except for my uncle on my father's side.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you just admitted that you value your family over God himself. Is that what you're telling me?
No, I'm simply saying that I value my family over these kosher laws.
That's fair enough.
Because as I told you, as a Reformed Jew, we don't believe that they are binding. However, I believe that they bring tremendous meaning because when you go and every day you have to pay attention to what you eat, then that reminds me of your heritage every single day. So I find it meaningful.
Honestly,
and it also, I'm not a very disciplined person, and so it brings a sense of discipline. But on the other hand, I'm not going to risk hurting my family's feelings by not eating their cooking, which they put a lot of effort and time into, and they serve with love. I'm not going to go without eating it because family's more important.
To be honest, that sounds very similar to me as far as Catholicism, where we don't eat meat on Fridays during Lent, and the only reason is basically it reminds you of what's actually important in life, which is, you know, focusing on God and things like that. And it sounds like that's more or less the reasoning behind the kosher laws, which is if you don't do this, if you don't eat this type of meat, this, you know, prepared this way or whatever, it reminds you that, hey, God is the most important thing in the world.
Right.
Okay. Before we wrap up, because I desperately want to get these podcasts in under an hour, it'll never happen. What is, for people that don't know, which is every idiot listening at halfguarded.com, what is a bar mitzvah and a bat mitzvah?
That means son of the commandments and daughter of the commandments. The idea of a bat mitzvah is fairly new. I think Reform Jews started it probably in the 50s or 60s. So basically it means that you're responsible for your own actions. At puberty, you were considered to be responsible for your own actions, and so religiously you were an adult. Also, during the time where the bar and bat mitzvah originated, the lifespan wasn't very long. It wouldn't be unusual for somebody to die in their 40s. That would be common, and so therefore, you know, it would be reasonable to get married at age 13, et cetera. And they also recognized that girls mature faster physically, and so they go through puberty earlier. So therefore, the Orthodox that have bat mitzvahs, they do that at age 12.
Fair enough. So it's basically just like a, I see it on TV.
It's like confirmation. A yarmulke is, or a kippah is a head covering, and that is just a tradition in Judaism that you cover your head, as a respect to God. I think that because God is everywhere, and I think that you put a barrier between yourself and God. If God is everywhere and has no form, then it's a little barrier. It's just more of a tradition.
All right.
Oh my God! I will take it in the ass if I have to because I love my husband.
The most observed is Passover, Pesach, which commemorates the Exodus. The reason why it is called Pesach or Passover is because when it's talking about the 10 plagues, the 10th plague after the Egyptians would not let the Israelites go, God said, you know, much like the Pharaoh ordered all of the firstborn of the Israelites to be killed, and, you know, Moses went down the river, and so he was saved by the Pharaoh's daughter. So in order to replicate that, the firstborn Egyptian would die. But also, the firstborn of anyone would die that was Jewish if they didn't, I mean, not Jewish, that was Israelite, if they did not follow God's commandment, which was to smear lamb's blood on the door.
I would say the door, and God would, like, he would walk by and say,
God would pass over those houses and would not kill their firstborn. That's the term Passover. And if you didn't smear the blood then on the door, then therefore, even if you were an Israelite, your firstborn would die as well, as you didn't follow the commandment. And so Passover is God would pass over the houses of the Israelites that smeared the blood on the door. And that is the most observed holiday, also very significant, and the most well-attended holidays in the synagogue. Judaism is centered in the home, but the most attended holidays in the synagogue are Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah literally means head of the year, and Yom Kippur is day of dread or day of atonement, and that is the Jewish New Year. That is the first 10 days of the year.
Have you ever smeared blood over your doorway?
No. However, they did that for Pesach. However, we have a mezuzot, where basically the mezuzot contains the Shema, the Vyahafta, in its complete form, and it's in a little it's in a metal case, which you will often see on the doorpost, because it says you should put them upon the doorpost of the house and on thy gates, and so that would be our central prayer. And you'll oftentimes in a Jewish home, you will see a mezuzot that tends to be, whether they're Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, or Reconstructionist, that tends to be a tradition that we've kept, where you go to a Jewish home and you'll see a mezuzot on the door.
This metal mezuzot box. What's in the box?
Yes.
Is there lamb's blood in the box?
No. There is the prayer that I mentioned earlier, the Shema and the Vyahafta, which talks about what is most central to Judaism. You know, you shall remember these commandments. You should be holy unto your God. You should speak to them when the sitteth in the house, when the walks by the way, when the lies down, when the rises up. And that's written in Hebrew.
Oh my God. I will take it in the ass if I have to, because I love my husband.
Well, I think that it's very significant that SmackDown is going live, and that they are doing the brand split again. I think that it might very well help SmackDown's ratings if it goes live, but then generally going live doesn't make much of a difference. It'll be interesting to see if they get better ratings on Tuesday. It's definitely worth trying. I don't like the idea of with the brand split, they're gonna come up with they'll have two world titles again, and they'll probably have the Intercontinental title on one show and the U.S. title on the other show, and I think that weakens the meaning of titles, and they tend to, like what they did last time, is they tend to emphasize the Raw title more than the SmackDown title, and one of the shows looks weaker. So hopefully they will not make that mistake again. I mean, I think that wrestling was stronger when you had champions that maintained the belt for a long time, because it gave the belt meaning. When Hogan was WWF champion for 4 years. That was actually a short reign, because Bob Backlund had it for nearly 6 years. Bruno Sammartino had it for 8 years. You never had a long heel title reign, with the exception of Billy Graham, who had it for 2 years. And so, as far as a face champion, 4 years was actually short. Can you imagine somebody holding the title for 4 years today? You know, I think part of the reason why Hogan was such a big star is because when Bruno had held the title for 8 years, it was just a regional company out of the Northeast. You had a company that had national exposure, and the champion held the belt for 4 years. I think if we went back to that, then wrestling would do better. Basically, they have a few dates a year where they do television tapings. I can't imagine you can make a living as a wrestler. The ratings are terrible. The company's for sale. I doubt they'll survive. I think that Ring of Honor has some hope, depending whether Sinclair puts some money into it. I don't think that syndication is dead, because Sinclair has it on a lot of their stations throughout the country, and I think they have it on a cable station as well. And I hear Sinclair might buy the Tennis Network and rename that, and then they would be on there too, is the rumor. So I think that Ring of Honor, there is there's competition for WWE. I know that New Japan is thriving, and I think that that in Mexico, AAA is doing pretty well.
So I guess this is a good way to finish the podcast here. If who is the heavyweight champion, the WWE undisputed, not before brand split, heavyweight champion of Judaism? Who's the top dude outside of God, obviously? Like, who's the top guy?
Moshe, of course, Moses.
Okay, and
it says in our in the Tanakh that there was no prophet again as great as Moses.
Did Moses have more than one wife?
No, just Zipporah.
Just one wife.
Zipporah was her name. Yes, just one.
And
she was not Jewish.
Really?
And yet Moses' children were considered Jewish, and so that's the discussion for another day.
Wait. He married a non-Jew?
Correct.
Whoa.
And so the Reform point to that, and they say, see, if your father is Jewish and your mother is not, you can still be Jewish. It was that way in biblical times, and so that's why the Reform will recognize descent from the father as well, but the other denominations will not.
That's actually really fascinating, to be quite honest. I would love to talk more about this, but I know you have stuff to do.
Well, we have to save something for next time.
Exactly.
You can do your research. If anyone wants to, they can look it up. Why is it the Reformed Jews recognize patrilineal descent and no other branch of Judaism does?
All right. That's
Reformed say it's either the mother or the father.
That's a fantastic way to end. Brent, I really want to thank you for doing this, because even though, you know, it's a bit of a – the halfcredit.com is a bit of a joke – I really want people to have an understanding, or, you know, somewhat a superficial understanding at least, of what the major religions are. You have a couple seconds here. Plug whatever you want to plug. Tell people, you know, what temple you're going to or what website, you know, besides WrestlingObserver.com. Dog, get away from the gate. Plug whatever you need to plug.
Sure. I belong to Temple of the Hirsch Sinai in Seattle. Rabbi Daniel Wiener is our head rabbi. We also have Rabbi Jacqueline Cohen, Rabbi Aaron Meyer, and Rabbi Micah Ellenson, and they're all outstanding. I have a Facebook page, but I don't want you to be my friend on my Facebook page. I have a fans and friends page on Facebook, and so if you know me personally, you can be my friend on Facebook. However, if you don't know me personally, please go to my fans and friends page, and if there's any Jewish women out there that are listening or that you know of that are between, you know, that are like 23 or older and can basically have children for the next 5 years, I need to have a Jewish family so I can pass on my religion to my children.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Wait, hold on.
God bless all.
Before we go, real quick, you have an unfiltered, because I'm not Chico, I'm not Dave, I will not stop you. Plead your case for why Missy Hyatt should marry you.
Well, I don't think that Missy wants to marry anyone.
Well, if she did.
Because Missy is a kind, funny, smart person. And she has had many men that have been interested in her. And Missy is in her, I believe, 53 years old. So if she'd wanted to get married again, she would have. I don't think that Missy wants to marry anyone. I would just like to go and spend some time with Missy Hyatt. She's interested in the Civil War. She does Civil War reenactments. She has a great history in wrestling. She has a great wrestling mind, and she has a lot of great stories of which she's written in her book. And then the one thing that's great about Missy is whatever you think about her, she embraces who she is. She's comfortable talking about what she has done in wrestling, and the men that she has interacted with, and I think that she actually gains respect rather than most people don't call her that word that is commonly called women that are judged for their history. Most people in wrestling don't call her that. They respect her because she's honest about who she is.
Would you marry Missy if she asked, even though she is probably unable to bear children?
Well, that's the issue, is that Missy is unable to bear children. I really don't think that she would marry anyone, and I would have to get to know her and find out whether we're compatible. So, you know, that would take some time. But if I ever want to marry a woman that is menopausal, then we would have to find a mother who's would be willing to give up their child, a Jewish, you know, a mother who's, whose mother is Jewish, you know, to give up her child or to donate an egg, because I would need to have, you know, somebody who's biologically, their mother is Jewish. So they'll recognize as Jewish by everyone.
So basically, you are willing to marry Missy if she will agree to let you find a Jewish woman with extra eggs laying around.
Well, if Missy and I were compatible, yes, but that's a stretch. I don't think Missy likes me very much based on our interaction.
Brent, who cannot like you? And Missy's been through the ringer. Maybe she needs a nice Jewish boy like you.
Maybe, but she also claimed to be not into Judaism anymore. She claimed to be into Scientology, which I listened to her on the Colt Cabana show.
Right.
And that's just something that she was just going to tell me if she talked to me. It's not really true. She just told me that to get me not interested, because the reality is Missy's not interested in me, and so she just told me that to get me not interested.
Well, Brent, I appreciate you being on the Half-Guarded Hour at halfguarded.com podcast. I think you have a shot with her. Do not, you know, sell yourself short. But again, I thank you for everything. One last quick plug before I hang up, and when I hang up, that'll be the end of the podcast.
Yes. Well, I appreciate everyone listening. I hope that I gave accurate information. I did the very best I could. I appreciate all my fans out there, and if anyone wants to contact me, get a hold of the people that on the shows that I'm on, and if there's any Jewish women out there, please let me know if you're capable of having children for the next 5 years. Thank you very much. Bye.
All right, everybody. If you're a Jewish woman, please marry Brent. Brent, thank you so much for everything. This is fantastic. We'll have you on again very soon. Have a good night.
Thank you. Bye.